You're going.
We are going.
Okay.
You want to put it in your pocket?
I don't. I will in a minute. I got to turn all these various electronics.
Okay.
Hopefully, this will throw my voice out to the rest of the room. I don't know. Doesn't sound like it. So sometimes it's.
Let me turn my chair on.
I guess that's great. Okay. We're going to use maps. And I'm going to point at parts of the map with my cool little red dot thing at that screen. Okay? So, who knows the name of the Pope in the 16th century who said, God has given us the papacy, now let us enjoy it? I don't either. And we're not going to study that. Okay? So what we're going to talk about is kind of looking at the church over 20 centuries, looking at it as an institution and how it relates to the government, to the state. So that's what institution relating to state is about. And then also how the church developed as a liturgical community. Okay? You remember liturgy is the appointed duties of worship for the people. Okay, that's what we do. So one of those is an exterior dimension, how we interact with others, the big power center of the state, and the other is an interior dimension, how we develop ourselves. Church history is also the history of Western civilization. So if any of you were awake during that class in high school, or maybe you took more of it in college, a lot of this should seem fairly familiar. But I'll try to make it approachable for those who slept through that class or, you know, they were physics nerds and didn't even like history. Okay? So, the first 300 years, the first thing the church had to kind of figure out was, what is our relationship with the Jewish faith? If you remember, I'm assuming many of you have read some of the letters of St. Paul, but there's an awful lot of talk of circumcision. Circumcision was the mark of being a child of Abraham. So how can you really be part of the descendant of Abraham if you don't have circumcision? And there was a lot of back and forth about that. One of the other big questions was, how bound are we as followers of the way? That was the early way they described the Christian faith. How bound are we to all the laws of Moses, the 613 laws? About what you eat, when you eat, how you mix what you eat. We recently celebrated a month ago the purification of Mary. So one of the rules was, after a mother had given birth, after 6 weeks, she would present herself as ritually clean at the temple. That's one of those types of laws. Now, is that binding on us as Christians? And it took them a long time to work it out. Paul was very sure that you didn't have to follow the Mosaic Law. He makes a big deal, particularly in the letter of Romans, that the purpose of the law was to expose our sin, and Jesus has redeemed us, and therefore we don't need the law anymore, and it should come and be written in our hearts. He was firm to the point of being nasty, even to Peter, when Peter kind of blended in with the community. When he was with non-Jews, he didn't follow the dietary laws, but when he ate with Jews, he did, and Paul rebuked him for that. So that was a big thing they spent the first 300 years dealing with. That's an internal thing. An external thing was the relationship with the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire didn't quite know what to do with these people. The Romans' approach when they conquered a territory was, if you had something really old, and they left it alone. And the Jewish faith was older than Rome, so they let them do their thing, even though, as we see in the gospel narratives, they were constantly fighting and troublemakers for the Romans. But are these new people some kind of Jews, or are they not some kind of Jews? And if they're not Jews, then they should probably be worshiping our state religions, which includes putting a pinch of incense for the emperor, and they won't do that. So are they disobedient, or are they atheists? That's one of the things that the Romans were trying to figure out. They didn't react to the Roman persecution the way the Jews did. They didn't go to arms. They went singing to the lions. So it was a conundrum for the Romans to figure out what to do. On an internal thing, dealing with doctrine and liturgy, the very first ecumenical council, an ecumenical council was when all the leaders of the church come together in one place. That's what you mean by that. Is actually in the scriptures, the Council of Jerusalem. When Paul goes to Jerusalem to talk with the leaders about what do we do about all these non-Jewish people who seem to, the Holy Spirit has descended upon them, he's baptizing them, they seem to be able to be good Christians, and yet they haven't been Jews. What do we do? And they had a long discussion about it and gave them kind of a very minimal guideline of what not to do, and primarily it was prudent, don't cause a scandal. The other thing they had to figure out is what do we do with what we think of as the scriptures, which we would call the Old Testament, and then these new letters. Paul's been writing letters and other people have been writing letters. We have these accounts of the story of Jesus when he walked with us. We need to organize that stuff. The first heretic was a guy named Marcion. Marcion didn't like the mean old God of the Old Testament, so he kind of chucked it. And he ended up not liking much except the letters of Paul. And the church had to say, you can't do that. So you already have, within 200 years, somebody who has picked up his Bible and is waving it in a particular way that is not consistent with the deposit of faith. Okay. How are we going to worship? The Christians took their Sabbath and put it on the day of resurrection, the Sunday, the God of the Sun, when Jesus rose from the dead. How are we going to worship? Because we can't go to the temple anymore because the Jews are persecuting us. So what are we going to do? And they developed the early liturgy was house churches. So somebody with a big house, they would have the memorial meal in that house, okay? Justin was a pagan convert to Christianity, and he went to Rome, and as a philosopher, he tried to present a reasonable argument in defense of the Christian faith. That's what an apology is. An apology is a defense of something. And he wrote in his apology, so he's writing to the emperor saying, we are not cannibals, because they saw that we eat my body and drink my flesh. We're not cannibals. And let me tell you what we do. And in this apology, which dates from about 160 AD, so that's just, 120 years after Jesus, he lays out what they do, and it sounds just like our Mass. He calls them different things. He talks about the memoirs of the apostles. We'd call that the Gospels. He talks about the man praying as long as he is able and to the best of his ability. We now, whether it's Father Morrow or Father McNamee or Father Panetta, they read a prayer from the book. But back then, it was sort of free form. But you would recognize what we do in Mass all the way back to 160 AD. And then Irenaeus, who is a few years later, and he is coming from a town in France called Lyon. We already are fighting with heretics and heresies. I mentioned Marcion, but the big one that infected and affected Christianity the most is something called Gnosticism. So the Gnostics believed that there was a special knowledge, Gnosis, that was only revealed to sort of the varsity players, I guess, if you will, okay? And they mixed in all kinds of fun, cool stuff. They had a whole bunch to do with certain numbers, and there was a lot of numerology associated with what they were doing. They were very drawn to the Greek idea of that the soul, the spiritual, is separate from the body, and they tended to think that the body was much less preferred than the spiritual or the mental, okay? So that tended to take them in two different directions. Some were extremely ascetic. Sex was so gross and physical, that they didn't do it, for example, or it took them the other side. Do whatever you want since the body doesn't matter. And so they did what you might do if you didn't, you know, I guess friends with benefits to the extreme. Okay? But Irenaeus is writing, correcting the errors of the Gnostics and other people who aren't holding on to the true faith. Okay? Okay, so I thought I'd give you a map. This is the Mediterranean, for those of you who are not familiar with your geography. That's the big blue area, okay? The little bit of blue area, this much bigger area, is at the Atlantic Ocean. That's Spain, that's France. There's the boot of Italy. This fingery thing is Greece. This we would call Turkey, they called it Asia. Here's the Middle East, here's North Africa, okay? That's sort of the known world. The red lines you can sort of see is sort of the boundaries of the Roman Empire. And working your way up that way was the Rhine River. That was sort of a boundary. And working your way in a long meandering way to dump into the Black Sea was the Danube. And those were kind of the boundaries of the Roman Empire at the time. Big cities, Rome, Alexandria. Alexandria was the town that Alexander built in Egypt. They had the big library there. It was a big center of Jewish intellectuals. You may have heard of the Septuagint. That was the Greek translation of the Greek scriptures, and that was all done out of Alexandria. And I didn't contrast very well. Antioch. Okay, that's one of the big centers of things, sort of sprinkled around the major cities of the Roman Empire. That area spoke Latin. That area pretty much spoke Greek, okay? I think I'm gonna throw more fun facts on you. You're gonna hear these town names again, but they come through all your early church history. Constantinople, we now call Istanbul, but that was the new imperial city that Constantine built for himself. Even though Rome is the heart of the empire, that effectively it was around the corner of the Aegean Sea, where today's sort of Croatia and Yugoslavia would be. But he built this city, and then right near it is a town called Nicaea. Around the corner at the edge of Asia Minor or Turkey is the town of Ephesus. Ephesus had a big Greek, I forget what Greek goddess was there. Devotion to, I forget who it was, but anyways, that is traditionally where John took Mary and lived, and it seems that Luke spent a great deal of time there with her, because in the Gospel of Luke there's an awful lot of infancy narrative stories about the birth of Jesus that most likely would have come from his mom. Chalcedon is another town. You can see that basically everything is along the shore that we're going to get to in a bit. And then here's some famous people. I mentioned Irenaeus up there in France. Augustine of Hippo, the guy who wrote the book Confessions and has that great line, "Our hearts were restless until they rested in you, Lord." He also had the other great line for all of you who are slackers, "Lord, make me chaste, just not yet." Then St. Cyril and St. Athanasius were strong defenders of orthodoxy, the Trinity in particular, out of Alexandria. St. Jerome was he really came from Rome, but he ended up in Bethlehem, and he is the guy that translated the Bible into the language of the day at that time, which became Latin. Okay, so now we're going to move into the 300s and forward, and you guys can stop me if I'm boring you or if I'm going too fast, okay? So the church had been periodically persecuted, first by the Jews, but then they got smashed into oblivion by 70 AD when they tore down the temple and Masada and all that stuff. So then they were just periodically pestered and then persecuted by Roman emperors, which was switching out with some regularity. And they endured some serious persecution right up until the late 290s, Diocletian. But then Constantine became one of the two main Caesars, and of course, once they were two, they had to have a fight to see if there was only going to be one. He won the Battle of Milvian Bridge. He said he had a sign from heaven that if he painted this cross sign on his standard, he would win the battle. So he did, and he won the battle. And shortly after that, he issued the Edict of Milan, which said that there was to be no more persecution of the Christians. Okay, so now they're being tolerated. The Christians back then are like today's Mormons. You know, weird religion, but they sure are good citizens. They're peaceful. They marry. They don't fight and have rebellion. They pay their taxes. I mean, their God tells them to pay their taxes. So these are good people. So rather than just tolerate them, we might sort of promote them. Tradition says that Constantine's mother, Helena, was a convert, probably more ardent, and before him. And she is the one who found the true cross and late in her life when she went to Jerusalem on a pilgrimage. So Constantine is a practical ruler, and he's like, you guys got to stop fighting over all this stuff. So come together and sort all your questions out. And so we have these councils. And I've got the town and the date over here, and I've got what they were fighting about over there. Around in the same time, they settled on the canon, the rule of the books that are going to be in the Bible. And I thought I'd share with you how they picked them. The book had to be old. It had to be orthodox. So for those of you who are trying to get the order of tradition and scripture, it is tradition that judged whether or not this would be scripture by figuring out whether it conformed to the faith that we already know and has been handed down to us from the apostles. And then another third consideration was that it's something that's been read in the liturgies. So if we found this old letter by Brad that was written in 34 AD, but no one's ever read it in Mass before, then that's not going to be one we included. And there are a number of scriptural writings that are not included because they were not orthodox. There are a number that are orthodox that were not included because it had sort of been covered. So the letter of St. Clement is an old, good letter. The Gospel of Thomas might be old, but it's not good. Okay? So just because Elaine Pagels likes it doesn't mean it's something you should necessarily consider orthodox. Okay, so what were they fighting about? You can see if you look at the dates on this, they got together every 50 or... And then sometimes they had to go a little quicker. But it took them about 400 years, 450 years to kind of sort things out. And the main thing they were sorting out was the challenge of Jesus. Okay? So the first thing they dealt with in Nicaea, and if you remember, all these towns are sprinkled around today's Turkey. Okay? And they didn't go far. They went to Nicaea, 25 miles away, Constantinople, a little bit further over to Ephesus, halfway back to Chalcedon. Constantinople for a couple of times and back to Nicaea. Okay, so they didn't go to the Bahamas. Okay, so the first thing is, and it's important to see that most ecumenical councils are responding to someone's proposal that seems to have gone beyond the boundaries of what we believe. Okay, so that's why it's generally not. Okay, and that's what anathemas are all about. If a guy persists in this, then he's not one of us, anathema, okay? So the first thing was this guy named Arius, who was very clued in to the fact that Jesus was a man. So he couldn't possibly also be God. He was just a really good man. And we hear elements of Arianism from lots of people, right? He was a good teacher, that type of a thing. The descendants of Arius today are Jehovah's Witnesses. They deny the divinity of Jesus. And he might be sort of a half a god, demiurge, but he's not equal with God. He's not the same thing. And if you think about our Nicene Creed, true God and true man, right? We insist on that. Of the same substance, consubstantial with the Father. That was one of the big fights they had. The Greek word for that is homoousios. And there were people who were trying to fudge and say, well, how about a similar substance, homoiousios, okay? Which is where you get the thing about not one iota's worth of difference. If you stick the iota between homo and usius, it becomes homoiousios, and they don't mean the same thing at all. Okay? So the first thing I had to say is not Arianism. And they began to develop their creed that they were going to recite. And that would kind of illuminate whether or not you were a true believer. They didn't really finish it. They had to come back together in about 50 years. And so that's why Constantinople, number one, is really not Arianism. And they fleshed out the creed to make this point over and over and over. Okay, so now we really know that Jesus is God. Well, then the next council is about Jesus, but it's where we get a lot of our Marian doctrines, okay? Was Mary Kilkos' bearer? Was she the bearer of the Anointed One, the Christos, okay, the Messiah? Or was she the bearer of God, Theos, okay? And there were a lot of people that didn't want, this is kind of hooking back into the fact that Jesus isn't really God. She's not the bearer of the Theos, she's the bearer of the Christos. And they insisted, no, she is the Theotokos. In Latin, it's the mother of God. That's why the mother of God is, it's mostly focusing on the God part, not the mother part. Okay? Then, these are fun words that you can use in your next crossword puzzle. And I better make sure I say them right or don't correct me. Okay, so monophysitism is your nature, okay? Does Jesus have one nature or does he have two natures, okay? The monophysites said he only has one nature, okay? And Christians say, no, one person, Jesus, two natures. He has a human nature and a divine nature, okay? So Nestorius came along in Constantinople II and said, well, if he has two natures, they're completely separate, okay? They don't touch overlap anyway, they're completely separate. And the church fathers said, no, Nestorius, you're wrong. He has two natures, but somehow, mysteriously, they're held in one person. And then finally, monothelitism is, does he have only one will or two wills? Does he have a human will and a divine will? And the church, this is why Jesus is such a challenge for us. He's fully God, and everything we mean about that, and he's fully human. To bring home the point of how fully human he is, I listened to a great scientific, it was really kind of a meditation, on the suffering of Jesus and the Passion. And he was focusing on the Shroud of Turin. Because there's an image on the Shroud of Turin that is clearly not painted on, but they can't figure out how it got on there. And this guy is a professor of microbiology. And so his hypothesis was, if Jesus was fully human, then like every other human, he's got little microbes crawling around his face all the time. And if he had gone through a day and a half of sweaty, bloody agony, on his body would be all the kind of things that microbes like to eat. So if you left a sheet over his face for a day and a half, the microbes would get busy. And in doing whatever they do, they would have transferred a 3D, and the other thing on the Shroud of Turin is it is 3D, it's not like a photo, would have transferred it from, you know, the contours of his face and his body onto the cloth. And so he tested this by smearing himself and whatever he did, and then trying to put a breathing tube in here and lie still for a day and a half, and it kind of worked. So that's how human he was. He had microbes growing all over him, okay? Just like you and I do. But he's also, okay, so that's kind of, if you're prone towards the Gnosticism, that's kind of gross and human and ucky, and that can't be God. But he's also fully God. So as we see at Good Friday, only God would love us so much that while he's dying for us, he is preaching to us. And that's what the seven last words are really about, is God preaching to us the fullness of the gospel, even as he's dying for us. Okay, so now, here comes your Western Civ. The Roman Empire, like a lot of empires in their dotage, got kind of fat and lazy. You know, a few years ago when there was a fighting over undocumented workers here, that they were doing the jobs Americans wouldn't do. Well, that's not new. The Romans thought the way to protect our border against the barbarians, and that's, they called people whose language they couldn't understand, it sounded like bar, 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 that's where you get the word barbarian. Okay, so people who just talk weird and we don't understand what they're saying, is we'll take people that used to be barbarians but have now become part of the Roman Empire, and we'll have them defend our border against the barbarians, because it's work we don't want to do. So you can see how there's a certain amount of rot has already come into the Roman Empire. And they hung on there for another few hundred years. But basically, it starts to fall apart. The story is, there's the Rhine River going up, dumping into the North Sea. And here is the Danube working its way down there. Well, all these hungry Teutonic tribes are blocked by that river until it freezes, and then they can cross. And that really began it. But you had these tribes just sweeping across all of Europe, okay? And this is a very short little jump, so they actually came around onto North Africa. You've heard of the Just War Doctrine that was developed, or proposed and initially developed by St. Augustine of Hippo. Well, the reason he's talking about is here we are sitting here as basically the bread basket of the Roman Empire, and our soldiers should defend us from these Vandals that have come in across and terrorizing our villages and towns. Okay, so in all of this sweeping of one type of bandit or barbarian tribe after another, the security and the safety and the vitality of the Roman Empire just goes away. And you end up never going anywhere else. You end up with little isolated villages, and they just don't even, they may have lost a lot of their knowledge about things because they're just trying to survive. And it's about 200 years of chaos and fear there. And in here, the church is the only thing that's stable. The Vandals, and I'm using that as a generic term, so the bad guys seem to be willing to respect the church. And so you have the bishops sprinkled in their various dioceses, and they're trying to be orthodox, but there's a lot of local variation, and there's a lot of Arianism in their Christianity. Okay? Now, I'm going to back up. You see how far it would be if you were intent on booty and destruction to get yourself up to Ireland. Okay? That's a hard journey. So the Irish were pretty much left alone. They had been evangelized by St. Patrick. He was captured as a slave by the Irish. He escaped. He went off. He got educated, became a priest, and went back to Ireland and converted them to Christianity. And within just a few hundred years, they had developed a strong tradition of monasteries in Ireland. They spent all their time copying the books, and so they kept the learning in a way that was unable to keep it over here. And so in the 7th and 8th century, the various saints went from Ireland over and evangelized Europe. Saint Columba kind of went over there and focused on Britain. Saint Columbanus went down here and worked his way through France and ended up down in northern Italy. And Saint Boniface went into the German territory. So that is how these Teutonic tribes finally heard the Orthodox gospel preached to them. Meanwhile, you've heard of Charlemagne? Well, there were a bunch before him. And these are the Franks, and they were taking their little dominions and turning it into something beginning to resemble France, okay? Charlemagne has gotten physical control of a big territory, and the Pope makes him the Holy Roman Emperor in 800 AD. And one of Charlemagne's things is to say, let's have the mass books that they use in Rome be the mass books that we use in all my territory, so at least I know they're all doing it in an orthodox way. And so he had, and the missal, you've heard that word, the missal? That's the mass book, okay? So he had the missals copied and spread around his dominions, which were pretty extensive at this point, okay? So that's the Carolinian Renaissance, all right? So now we're up to around 800, 900, okay? Moving at a pretty good clip. Any questions? Any history corrections? You know, 400 to 800, something like that, 400 to 700. I think the Dark Age is, depending on your perspective, I mean, they're darker in some places than others. Yes, ma'am. Well, if I can back up, okay. They're not having any problem with Teutonic hordes down here. So the East, the Greek and Arab side, is relatively peaceful at this point, okay? So all the trouble is up here. They're swinging around, and so it's really affecting Milan and Rome, but it hasn't really wandered down to Constantinople yet.
I meant in the previous slide, or fourth century.
This one? Well, that's what the councils are for. The masses had not been like standardized. Okay, this is, they're still in the place where you get a really good preacher and he preaches well.
Right, but I guess I'm understanding is that they were coming together as a council to kind of agree
yes.
on what was. So what were they using as a reference or something?
Well, that I guess sacred tradition. I mean, that's why I touched on the fact that it's Orthodox, okay? We know, now we is probably, you know, the 17 of us, like Irenaeus and Augustine and Ambrose. We know what the apostles taught. So let's not have any books that don't, that argue with what we know the apostles taught. Does that make sense? So the books actually came after. Remember, this is a culture where you would have memorized great chunks of things that you and I now just go to Google for. Okay? They didn't have Wikipedia back then. You don't have to remember anything anymore because the internet does for you. Okay? All right. So here we are in the High Middle Ages. Okay? Europe is feudal. It's not futile, feudal. You've got the lord. It's agrarian. It's a fairly ordered society. It's except for the fact that, you know, feudal kings have to go out and contest each other on a regular basis, but even that is orderly. So it's a fairly peaceful, homogeneous area, okay? And the church is the thing they all share. They needed to have educated clergy. So next to the cathedrals, quickly developed schools. This is probably around 1,000, okay? Bologna is in Italy. Paris, I hope you know where that is. Cambridge is up there in Britain. Cologne is in the German territories, and Salamanca is in Spain. Okay. We'd had the development, but then a flowering of more monasteries of different orders. The Franciscans and the Dominicans show up around this time. They fall into some weaknesses, so they're constantly renewed, and that's what Clairvaux and are all about, the Cistercians. Okay, these are sort of renewed versions of orders that had been around for a while, Benedictines or others. The learning from the ancient Greeks had been lost in the Dark Ages, but through the Crusades, Christians came into contact with Muslims, and there was a tradition, particularly over in this part of the world, of Muslim philosophical and scientific inquiry, and they had kept the books, the writings of Aristotle and Socrates and that kind of stuff. So that came back around into the learned centers of Europe, and men like St. Thomas Aquinas took this ancient Greek philosophy, Aristotle's realism, and used it as a way to systematically examine and try to answer questions of the faith. So if you've heard of something called the Summa Theologica, that's what that is, okay? 1100, the High Middle Ages are 1100 to 1300, 1400, something like that. Some other cool things that happened, when you as a group of monks decide that you're gonna go put your building on the top of a mountain, you've just signed up to become engineers and solve problems like how do we get the good stuff up and the bad stuff down, okay? So a lot of development of things just because they weren't constantly running from marauders. The economy begins to become a little bit more complex. You begin to have traders and bankers of a sort. So it really began to develop. A couple of the orders, like the Franciscans and the Dominicans, they didn't hang out in their monastery all the time. They were walking around. They're called the mendicant orders, orders of preachers and the orders of friars. And they were also a means for taking the liturgical books and spreading them around. So the worship became a little bit more uniform. Okay? And then, this is important for where we're going to next. I picked this date, sort of roughly 1100, as the last time in certainly Western civilization that everybody from the king to the lowest peasant all knew that they all answered to the same God and the same moral standard. You guys heard of the story of Henry II, who was he was the king of France and England, and there was a cleric, Thomas Becket, who was particularly orthodox and rigorous and was annoying the whatever out of the king. And in a fit of rage, he said, "Won't someone rid me of this meddlesome priest?" Well, four of his knights were, you know, thought they knew what their master told them to do, so they went and they killed Thomas Becket. Everyone knew why, and a year later, Henry goes up to Canterbury Cathedral and puts on a hair shirt and crawls into the cathedral as a public act of penance. And I gotta think that's the last time anyone with that much power did anything like that. I just can't imagine President Trump or President Obama before him doing anything like that. And I can't think of a European leader. Next thing the kings all developed is the divine right of kings, you know, so that now God made them king and they can do what they want. But that's about the last time that you had sort of pure Christendom, where the church was the source of moral authority, the king knew it, and the peasant knew it. Okay? Okay. Now, meanwhile down south, okay, so this is what was going on down in this area where Christianity started and where it flourished all the way along in here. Well, this is Muhammad, okay? And let's see if I can read this for you. Okay, so this pink area, 1632. Orange, 25 years later. Purple, another 10 to another 100 years. So set by 750, all of this is Muslim, okay? The early story of Muhammad is he had these visions. He went to the pagans in Mecca, which is where he was from, and he said, "You've got to stop serving those pagan gods. You've got to serve Allah. There is only one God," okay? They beat him up and kicked him out, and he went over to Medina, where he regrouped, got a bigger group of followers, came back and beat the tar out of the Mecca and took over, okay? So from the very beginning, Islam was both a system of government and a religion. And part of their belief system involved spreading it to everybody. They came all the way around and took over Spain, and they went all the way up. That's Tours, that's a town in France. Charlemagne, I mentioned, Charles the Great, Charlemagne. His grandfather was Charles the Hammer, Charles Martel. He was the one that beat them back. They went back across the Pyrenees and stayed. But let's see, 1683, I think, is when they got to the gates of Vienna, where they lost a battle because they didn't worry about they were so confident in their ability to win that they didn't protect their flank. And a Polish general brought his army around the backside and routed them. And the date of that was September 10th, 1683, which is why those planes flew into our buildings on September 11th. It was payback. Okay, so the Muslim way of dealing with non-Muslims was to give them a choice. You can convert and stay. so now you're a Muslim, or you can pay a tax if you're going to stay. And that was really the end of Christianity as a major force all along in here. And today you see on the news that Christians are being killed in these territories because they're Christian, which is why Monsignor Lopez always adds them to the prayers of the faithful in any mass and sermon, because he's aware that people are being martyred today. So our relationship with Islam, the Islamic leaders, from the European perspective, has been a long period of trying to figure out how to coexist. Okay, any questions about that? Okay, hopping back up to kind of transition. So I mentioned that the states united to serve the faith, that's really what the Crusades were about, okay? It started as a pilgrimage. It, because we're fallen, it quickly turned into something else. And so there was raping and pillaging, and on their way back through is when they just ransacked Constantinople and took stuff. About 1100 was about when the states, the last time they sort of united to serve the faith. Fairly quickly after that, they began to think of themselves as Italians or French or German. This is about 1300 is when their languages begin to develop. The reason why Italian sounds like Italian is because this is the time when Dante wrote his Divine Comedy. And so his language became Italian, pretty much. Okay, and that's going on in Germany, that's going on in England, that's going on in France, it's going on in Spain. And so going along with this great growing sense of a national identity is a reduced sense of seeing the church based in Rome as something other than an Italian church. The Pope had a little area that he owned as a feudal lord, the Papal States. So it's easy, and he would ride in at the head of armies. So, you know, what is he? Is he a spiritual leader that we all answer to, or is he just some Italian warlord like all the other ones? Okay. And this was, you know, kind of a new stream of thinking. And then another thing that happened in this time frame is the development of the printing press. When you have to copy a book by hand, it kind of raises the threshold of what's worth copying, right? And it takes a long time to copy it. When you can take your movable type and get it set up and do this, you know, 100 times, it's easier for you to get your idea out quickly. And there's less of a time of distillation, if you will, okay? So we see with the internet that you can tweet something out to, you know, your 10,000 followers instantly, and sometimes you realize after the fact maybe you shouldn't have tweeted that. Okay, so technology has developed. Okay, now we're going to get to the Reformation, sort of after the Reformation, okay? So part of what happened in the Reformation was partly political and partly religious, okay? There were terrible abuses by bad men who happened to be popes. One of them was the guy that said that God has given us the papacy, now let us enjoy it. He wants a big new building, St. Peter's Basilica. He knows that the faithful want indulgences. They want to share in the merits of the martyrs and the saints. And so he's okay if some people want to monetize that thing and let guys go around and say, if, you know, by the time the coin hits the box, you'll have gotten away with some days in purgatory, okay? Which is all a total abuse of Christian teaching. But guys were doing that, okay? So Martin Luther was not way out of line with his objections to the abuses that were going on. And the church had been trying to implement corrective procedures for about 100 years before Martin Luther posted his 95 Theses. But national politics kicks in. They wouldn't call a conclave. The Pope wouldn't follow through on the agreement that he would have a council. They would have a council and then not follow through the implementation of it. These are all human failings. there were some who, there had always been an element of Puritanism in the faith. The Albigensians, the Cathars, these are all the people that wanted to purify the faith from various sort of add-ons that crept onto it. So this is a regular kind of purification cycle that the church goes through. This time it just went so far that it broke the church in two, okay, or three. But one of the things that was going on was the papacy was sometimes under the control of one guy or another. There was a stretch where we had two popes, which really makes it hard for me to understand how you can be the vicar of Christ when there's two of you. You know, how can you be the supreme authority when there's two of you? And for a very brief moment, there were three of you. The part of the reason why England, why Henry could not get his annulment was because the woman that from whom he was seeking a declaration of nullity was the daughter of the King of Spain, who currently had the Pope invited as his guest with no hope of leaving. That's probably the one declaration of nullity that is not going to be granted, even though Henry had an excellent case. Okay? Martin Luther. In this territory, it looks like Germany, but it was really a bunch of little duchies and fiefdoms and kingdoms and free cities. And so you had all these princes. It was convenient to them to have a guy who was against the Pope, but religious. So I've heard a priest, he said his dissertation was going to be called, did Martin Luther jump or was he pushed? There was a lot of politics involved in the German Reformation. There were other places where it was much more, it didn't have to do with politics, like John Calvin, but a certain amount of national politics went into the Reformation. Then we had the wars of religion, okay? Because now we have territories that are defending the true faith under the banner of the Pope, and territories that are defending the true faith under the banner of the Queen of England, who was also the head of the Church of England. So you have things like the Armada. You guys ever heard of the Armada? So Spain is the biggest dog in the pack here. I mean, they've got all this territory over here in the Western Hemisphere. They got all this gold they've been stealing from the Aztecs and the Incas, so they're super rich. And they've got a big army, and they're just going to go up there and teach those heathens a lesson and convert them back to the papacy. Well, technology had developed. One of the problems you have here is if you have big ships that are used to being pushed by the wind, and the wind tends to push you right through the English Channel, what are you going to do when you're fighting smaller ships that have sails that allow them to sail against the wind a little bit better? And what if these smaller ships have really good guns that were recently developed, and so they sail up on your backside, which is your weakest side, and they poke a hole in your stern, and you sink. Meanwhile, you're getting pushed by the wind out here, and the only way home is to go around the top. And along the way, you lost most of your men. The myth of the Black Irish is that, I don't know what they mean by that, but I guess the people with black hair in Ireland are the Spaniards that fell off the ship. I don't know if that's true or not. But they fought about this stuff for about 100 years. And after 100 years, it really kind of settled into, you had Catholic countries like Spain and France and Italy and southern Germany, like Bavaria, and then you had strongly Protestant areas like northern Germany, the Netherlands, the Danish and Norwegian area, and then England, okay? England itself kind of went back and forth, but ended up with a very pragmatic, middle-of-the-road Protestantism. I think the Queen famously said that she would not presume to look into the hearts of men. Which meant, if you don't make a big fuss, I won't ask you what you believe. You can see how if that's the message from the head of your church, religion can't be all that important, right? So just be a good British man and woman and build up the empire, I guess. Who am I to judge? Right. Go along to get along. Okay, so after the wars of religion, we're worn out. Let's not fight about that stuff anymore. Why don't we spend our time on learning that isn't connected to the revelation of God, burning bushes and other things like that. A big part of the Reformation involved throwing out what was concluded to be a bunch of, well, hocus pocus. Okay, hocus pocus was the pejorative term used by Englishmen because those are the words that the priest would say in Latin when he elevated the host. Here is my body, hoc est corpus meum, right? So they said whenever they wanted to make fun of something, sort of magically becoming something else, that's a bunch of hocus pocus, and that's where they got it. Okay. So why don't we just do some book learning and some science learning. When Aristotle's system of thinking, the metaphysics, was as a gift back to Western civilization, it was a great gift. His physics, his understanding of nature, was not really good. Okay? And so as their tools are getting better, their system of measuring things, their system of observing things, smart men who have time to do this are figuring out that an awful lot of Aristotle's physics is just wrong. But the church, being very conservative by nature, is reluctant to just say, yep, you're right, he's wrong. So they were very slow. You may know the story of Galileo. He had really good telescopes. He measured very carefully. He proved that the Earth revolved around the Sun, not the other way around, okay? Which was a thought that had been offered by a Catholic priest, you know, hundreds of years before. The Pope didn't disagree with him, but wanted him to go slow about putting it out as the truth. And Galileo didn't want to do that, and that's why the Pope imprisoned him and mistreated him. But it took the church, what, 300 more years to admit that we mistreated him? So, you know, that's the slow-moving part of the church. But the rest of the world is moving along at a pretty good clip. We have something called modernism that comes out of the Enlightenment. Okay, the Enlightenment was an effort to say, let's come up with a system that doesn't rely on the Catholic Church or God. Okay? And the relationship between man and nature changed. Okay? If you were an ancient or you were a medieval Christian, as a man, a human, you found your place in nature. As a more modern man, nature was something that you dominated. You controlled nature. You were no longer cowering in the barn when lightning is flashing because that's God doing his thing in his heavens. You're out there with a kite and a key to figure out that that's electricity, and then you're beginning to think about what you might do with electricity. You're going to end up inventing the light bulb and things like that, right? Okay, so this, the posture of man to the natural world changed dramatically. Rationalism, so just using the power of your reason, became a great ideal and really the greatest ideal. Francis Bacon is the one who talked about man should dominate nature. And then you have the rise of the secular nation state. The clearest and first example of this is the French Revolution. Part of the thing was, you know, the old regime, the Ancien Régime, is dead, so they killed it off. They got rid of the calendar. They made up their own calendar. They got rid of the ancient way of measuring. They made up their own one called the metric system because it was all very rational. It doesn't actually work rationally, but it did for them. It was all by 10, things like that. They tried to take things and get rid of God and have the goddess of reason and things like that. Very purposefully coming up with a way to explain and direct that had no connection to the church. Okay? The church knew that this was wrong, but they couldn't say much more than no. Okay? They knew that the seven sacraments were correct, but that's all they could say. They knew that where Martin Luther had gone relying exclusively on scripture was wrong. So they made sure in the Council of Trent, which was the Catholic response to the Reformation, that to articulate the books in the Bible, to articulate the seven sacraments, to articulate the importance of sacred tradition, okay? And they kind of sat there knowing that there was a bunch of lying going out there, but here in the safe zone, we're going to hang on to the truth, okay? And very much of an inward-looking thing. As this stuff goes on, because we're now marching from 1700 to 1800 and 1900, okay? They can come up with an index of forbidden books. Don't read these bad books. They can come up with the syllabus of errors. Pope Pius IX did that. But they really just kind of stayed hunkered in the bunker, okay? Then Vatican II was really a change in tone, and it had been building for 80 years, I think, something like that, to say, we need to have a dialogue with the world. Pope John the 23rd said that we should throw open the doors of the church to the modern world. And what he meant by that was that we should go out and preach to the world. What sort of happened was a lot of the bad stuff of the world came inside the church, but we're working on that. Okay, so now one of the things that happened was, after 400 years of trying total reliance on reason, it didn't really work, because if you don't have a unifying objective source of morals, of what's good and what's evil, and you just left to reason, at some point you will end up with pragmatism, and you will find yourself saying things like, I'm willing to endure a little collateral damage, you know, that I needed to kill that Muslim warlord, and I killed a few innocent civilians on my way. I need to stop the World War II, and those pesky Japanese will fight every single island like it was the most important island in the world, so we'll just nuke one of their university towns to make sure they understand how serious we are. And if they don't give up, 9 more days, we'll nuke another one, okay? So that's where you end up if you don't have an objective, supreme moral authority. Nietzsche was a German philosopher writing in the late 1900s, and he said that if God is dead, and he thought God was dead, then what you're left with is will to power. And what he meant by that is, the only limit to what you can do is what someone will do. So you end up kind of devolving to the guy with the greatest willingness to get blood on his hands will end up running the show. That modernism tried to have the benefit of Christianity, a supreme rational arbiter of good and evil, without the structure of Christianity, and it didn't really work. We ended up with World War I, where Germans and Frenchmen shot at each other for 4 years and moved, 100 yards. The sons of the French Revolution were the Bolsheviks, Lenin, Stalin, Mao, Pol Pot, the Hutus, and we have killed 100 million people in the 20th century, and not just that way. We've killed 55 million through abortion and euthanasia, something like that. So postmodernism is a bunch of people kind of wandering around in a scientific golden age. We've got Twitter, but it's a philosophical dark age because, to talk about this stuff, you can't do it in 140 characters. And in some ways, we've kind of returned to the dark ages, and then no one knows how to think anymore. You go read argument, and Aristotle would look at that stuff and say, that is not an argument. That is whining. A whole bunch of fallacies of making, calling the other person names because you don't actually have an argument. A lack of rigor in sticking to the point of the argument. So, your friends in debate club know how to make an argument, but your friends in politics know that there's no point in having an argument when you can cut the corner by some kind of emotional appeal or emotional attack on somebody, right? So, why would you need to discuss anything if I can just say you're a hater when you disagree with me, right? That sort of ends the discussion. becomes name calling. And the gift of the church to learning, the university, has been so thoroughly deconstructed that we now have microaggressions and safe zones and speech codes and things like that, right? So this is our opportunity as Christians to kind of re-evangelize the world. That's what Pope Benedict was talking about in John Paul II. The new evangelization is actually going to start in our own buildings, because there are an awful lot of people who are good Catholics, but they don't really know what that means. And they don't know where to go get the tools to figure out what that means. And so you're doing RCIA, you're actually probably better equipped than a lot of folks your age who were Catholic since they were kids. And I'm sure many of the sponsors would attest to the fact they learned a lot as being a sponsor, that maybe they heard it in CCD, but they can't remember it. But out of Vatican II, the priests and the deacons are here to let you be renewed so that you can go out and change the world, okay? That's what the new evangelization, it is the job of the laity to go out and change the world. You can't wait for St. Columba or St. Columbanus, you're him. And so it's important that you know your scripture and that you know your tradition and you know your faith and that you can project it through how you live. And then if you get in a discussion with someone, that you can communicate it with love, okay? You may not have all the tools in the toolbox, which is what the catechism will help you with. You know, you've got a lot of resources in this community and online to help you as you kind of beef up your knowledge in your toolbox. But then it's really how you use the tools in your toolbox that's going to be the new evangelization, which we so desperately need. And an awful lot of people who do abortion, they didn't really pick it exactly. They don't quite know how they ended up being a party to an abortion. And they're dealing with the burden of that for the rest of their lives. And so somehow or other, the love of God has to be communicated equally with the truth of God as we help those people heal, turn around, and make a new path for themselves. And so that's why I always say that some of the most important words are the last ones in the Mass, that the deacon says, go. The Mass is over, and that means it is sending, okay? It is the time for sending. So you should go out and change the world. Okay?
Do you need to turn that back on? There's plenty of time for questions.
Oh, sorry. Yes, I have as many questions as you want. Yes, ma'am. I think I'm going to turn this off, though, right, sweetheart?